The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I spoke recently with my friend Anthony Johnson. He's a leader in drug policy reform, truly a drug policy revolutionary, one of the chief petitioners for the Oregon ballot measure 91, which legalized adult social use of marijuana in 2014, also a chief petitioner for ballot measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which passed overwhelmingly in the 2020 general election. We're going to hear that conversation on today's show, but first... Damon Barrett is the co-director of the International Center on Human Rights and Drug Policy, which he co-founded in 2009. He's an associate senior lecturer at the School of Public Health and Community Medicine, Sahlgrenska Academy, University of Gothenburg. His most recent book, Child Rights and Drug Control in International Law, was published by Brill Martinus Niehoff in 2020. He spoke recently about child rights and drug control in a webinar hosted by Swansea University's School of Social Sciences.
Over the decades, and culminating, I think, in a kind of peak in the late 1980s, you've got the increasing threat of illicit trafficking. Back in the 1930s, there was an effort to have a global drug trafficking treaty, but it was a failure because states didn't want to take on board those kinds of obligations. But by the late 1980s, with especially the Latin American organized criminal organizations, there was more of an impetus now for a drug trafficking treaty. And it's here that we see the references to children coming through. In the preamble of the convention, now we're talking about the threat posed to children by drug use and the drug trade as, quote, a danger of incalculable gravity. So that's the preamble of the treaty framing the transnational criminal law that comes later on. And then later on, what we see is reference to children in relation to aggravating circumstances, which should increase penalties for certain crimes, including the location where a crime took place. So if a certain, including sales and so on, if these things take place in places where children and young people socialize, that's one of the aggravating circumstances, which was objected to. But not very, very strongly by the Netherlands, who said that that's entirely too broad, especially if you take it to an inner city location. On the other hand, this question of incitement came back. And now it's sailed through with no concerns, voiced at least, about freedom of expression and so on. So one of the things that's stated in the drug trafficking treaty is that unless it's contrary to states' constitutional principles, they should criminalize encouragement or incitement to use drugs. During the 1980s, at the same time, we've had the drafting of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It took 10 years, from 78 till 89, to do it. And from the earliest input, there was a desire to see drugs included within it. Like one of the first letters that I found in the archives in Geneva referred to that... the desire to see drugs included. I believe the letter was from an Argentinian group. But the actual issue didn't come up for quite some years. It was originally proposed by China that drugs be included in the treaty, in coinciding with China's adoption of a new anti-drugs police force. So there was clearly like a concern in the early 80s with China, diplomatically and politically in China with this. The text that was ultimately adopted went through a few different drafts, but it was a kind of an amalgamation of some NGO suggestions and the original Chinese suggestion, which was simply to punish those who encourage children to use drugs and to prevent children and young people from doing so. The original wording included the prohibition of incitement to use drugs, as had come up with the... drug trafficking treaty, but it was rejected. And interestingly, it was rejected by the United States, which didn't want to see it in there. So there we see incitement rejected in the Convention on the Rights of the Child and accepted in the drug trafficking treaty, which we'll hold on to as a point for a moment. On the other hand, The issue of stringent penalties was also rejected in the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The idea that there was original wording to have stringent penalties for those who encourage young people to use drugs. And while children are part of the aggravating circumstances in the Transnational Crime Treaty, the idea of stringent penalties doesn't get into a child rights treaty. Finally, with regard to root causes, the Convention on the Rights of the Child changed its wording away from preventing young people from using drugs to a protection framework, which started looking more broadly at the kind of social, and this is the wording used, social measures that might be used to do so. So there the root causes were more readily acceptable. So we see the differences between the two processes. So one of the stories that you hear is that the Convention on the Rights of the Child refers to the Drugs Conventions. And the Drugs Conventions refer to children, and therefore they converge. They are in harmony. They're both pushing in the same direction. But if we look at it in a different way, they're both different legal traditions. One of them was being adopted as a part of human rights law. The other system was looking at commodity control and transnational criminal law, and they're not necessarily going to lead to the same kinds of ways of looking at issues, as we see with incitement, penalties, and root causes. On the other hand, we've got something, if we pay attention to the position of the individual in each system, it's very different. In transnational criminal law, the individual is an object of the interventions by states. They're preventing people from doing things. They're catching people doing things, right? Whereas in human rights law, and this was one of the big innovations of the Convention on the Rights of the Child for children, is that the individual is a subject of rights and that has claims against the state. That's quite different. Professor Neil Boister has pointed this out, that the rights of the individual are largely lacking in the international drug control system. And finally, we've got what these treaties are for. I mean, tautological as it might sound, the Convention on the Rights of the Child aims with the full realization of children's rights, and there's lots of sub-goals within that. Whereas the drug control system is aiming at the effective suppression of certain kinds of substances. They're not the same goals. They might converge, they might diverge. So maybe what we actually have in the development of parallel systems is a degree of fragmentation rather than simple coherence. So I decided to take this, and I was looking at the ways in which this relationship between the two treaties is seen by UN mechanisms, by states in their statements at the UN General Assembly, were the data I used for that, but also among NGOs, of which myself and Rick were a part. And I broadly characterized two positions that I identified that have different ways of looking at the relationship between child rights and drug control laws based on their assessment of what the risk is and where the threats are coming from. On the one hand, the threat could be drugs themselves. On the other hand, the threat could be what states are doing to control drugs. Another one is differences in how the relationship between the treaties is seen legally, in that some would see a hierarchy between the two, in which human rights is higher, and the other see no hierarchy at all. And the other one is the actual content of Article 33 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, where some focus on pointing to the coherence between the two treaty systems, and the other trying to look at the normative status of this phrase, appropriate measures. What's appropriate from a child rights perspective? So the first grouping, or the first kind of heuristic that I developed, was I referred to as the drug control position, where you see advocates and states and others planting their feet within drug control and looking at human rights from that direction. And when this happens, what you see is an argument that where the drugs conventions inform how we interpret the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which in turn reaffirms the drugs conventions with human rights law. Through that rationale, children have a right, a human right, to what the drugs conventions require states to do. On the other hand, and this is where I found myself as an advocate, is what I would call the human rights position, where feet are planted in human rights law, more broadly within which the Convention on the Rights of the Child is a part. And this informs how we interpret the drugs conventions. And this restrains how we interpret or how states implement the drugs conventions in order to ensure that human rights violations on the ground don't happen. And the question becomes, could state obligations, or as the Convention on the Rights of the Child says, appropriate measures, start to look different depending on which frame of reference you use? If you plant your feet in drugs control and look at child rights law, or if you do it the other way around and you plant your feet in human rights law and look at drug control from that perspective. And what I found was, yes, you start to find different kind of debates and different kind of tensions happening depending on which way you look at it. And none of them are especially wrong. This is the nature of the debate that we're in. But that's the advocates and some of the some states and some of the UN mechanisms. I also looked at the reporting process to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child from 1993 to 2019. And here, this is a process where states every few years have to report to this committee, which is set up under the convention. And they have to tell it, basically, in a report, what they're doing to implement the convention. So necessarily within that, they will have to tell the Committee on the Rights of the Child what they're doing to implement that article about drugs. So this was of interest to me. So I looked at over 450 reporting processes, this dialogue between states and this committee. And what I found that is that there's a series of issues that are always in focus. Poor data is a big one, and it's super important. Recommendations from the Committee for Prevention and Treatment Efforts to be child-friendly. And states regularly talking about their prevention and treatment efforts as part of the obligation to protect children. From 2010 onwards, we see the Committee on the Rights of the Child frequently referring to harm reduction efforts for children and young people who use drugs. But we don't really see what a child rights-based approach to treatment or harm reduction or prevention would be from what the committee and the states tend to say. The committee is consistent that young people under 18 should not be criminalized for their drug use or possessing drugs. It's been saying that since the early 2000s to states. And I'll hop over alcohol and tobacco for now because it's a separate kind of a parallel thing that's been happening. But then there's a bunch of issues that are neglected in this whole dialogue. Nobody talks about access to controlled medicines, meaning those substances that we otherwise criminalize if they're used for medical or scientific purposes. In this case, pediatric medical purposes. That doesn't come up at all. Issues relating to parents and pregnancy doesn't come up between states and the committee very often, except to the extent that former Soviet states regularly talk about challenging custody on the basis of people being on drug user registries. The supply side of the situation is rarely talked about. So children's involvement in the drug trade, whether it's in terms of production or in terms of sales or transit or any of that stuff, doesn't really come up. And for me, a very important part, and for that human rights position, a very important part, is the effects of drug control efforts on broader child rights doesn't come up, which is quite interesting because so many of the efforts that states report to the committee are things that are risky from a human rights and a child rights perspective. But that just doesn't come up in the discussion.
That was Damon Barrett. He's co-director of the International Center on Human Rights and Drug Policy. His most recent book, Child Rights and Drug Control in International Law, was published by Brill Martinus Niehoff in 2020. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Anthony Johnson is a leader in drug policy reform. He was a chief petitioner for Oregon's ballot measure 91, which legalized adult social use, sales, and production of marijuana. He was a chief petitioner for ballot measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which was approved overwhelmingly by Oregon voters in the 2020 general election. Anthony Johnson is also someone I'm proud to call friend. He's on Zoom with me now. Anthony, how the heck are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, all things considered, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my friend, it's a pleasure. Now, I want to ask you about DATRA, Measure 110. At the time of this recording, it's been nearly a year since the vote. Some parts of the measure went into immediate effect. The rest is being implemented. Now, full disclosure before we start. I supported the campaign. I signed the petition. I voted yes on 110. I did so because I thought that passing Measure 110 would mean that cops in Oregon would stop wasting so much time and so many resources harassing people who use drugs, that people who did have the misfortune of being busted with small amounts would no longer clog up the courts and fill the jails and burden the probation system, and that some of the excess revenue from marijuana sales would go into services and supports to help people stabilize their lives and to make positive changes, the kinds of services and supports that are absolutely vital to real recovery. So, Anthony, give us an update. What's happening with Measure 110? How is implementation rolling out?
Yeah, as far as ending the criminal persecution and prosecution and the harms that the drug war has done to people who possess and utilize drugs, disproportionately people of color and poor people in general, Measure 110 has effectively done its job on that front. In my opinion, Oregonian just reported that drug arrests in Oregon have gone from 1,200 a month down to 200 a month. And it's being spun that that's a bad thing. But I think as far as what the voters have wanted and that what you know about most people who utilize drugs don't have an addiction problem, don't need the criminal justice system, that has been a plus. And then with 1,000 less drug arrests every month, then that is money saved from law enforcement and judicial costs. And theoretically, law enforcement should be able to tackle other crimes. The other component is helping get treatment to those that do want it. And the media, I think, has done a disservice just pointing out that people that have gotten tickets haven't utilized the hotline to get treatment. That ignores the fact that people are getting treatment in other ways, and treatment providers, both for drug addiction treatment, harm reduction services, and recovery programs, have already gotten funding that they wouldn't have gotten. They've already gotten $30 million. They're set to get $300 million over the next 2 years. That's additional funds that they wouldn't have gotten. So we're going to see even more resources available to people. But for instance, Bridges to Change, which offers peer recovery support, housing, and treatment services, they were going to close their doors in Wasco County. Measure 110 funding helped keep them open and enable them to expand. The Miracles Club here in North Portland, which primarily helps African-American community, they're able to hire three more staffers and support staff to help people out of $200,000 plus that they got out of the first round of funding. So we're going to see more funding and we're going to see more benefits to this program, but there definitely is a concerted effort by law enforcement and opponents to already paint Measure 110 as a failure, but we got to give it time to work out. And I think not ruining people's lives through a racist drug war is a better policy for all Oregonians.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the pushback was to be expected. Some district attorneys and police are going to complain because they're not ruining enough lives. And unlike with drug court, they can't just rack up impressive numbers by busting people who don't actually have a substance use disorder and then forcing them into unnecessary treatment. You know, a provider's success rate really does soar when the only problem the people they're treating had was, you know, bad luck, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, having the good fortune of having sufficient money and other resources to hire a good lawyer and pay for a treatment program. So we know the people who opposed Measure 110 back in 2020, we knew they were going to gripe about it and try to block its success. What can be done to support the measure moving forward and to ensure that it continues operating successfully?
Yeah, keep paying attention to the media stories and comment on them, share your views with friends and family. And this is going to come up through, the legislature is going to be looking to address these issues that come up and just be active in those realms. And make sure you pay attention to the Health, Justice, and Recovery Alliance. That's the coalition of numerous organizations that are working to implement this law, and and to really spread the word that there are more resources available when people that do need help to get assistance. You don't have to get a citation or be arrested to get access to these treatment and recovery programs. They're available to all Oregonians.
Yeah, unlike with drug courts, when that was the way to get your treatment was to get busted first.
Exactly.
Now, the gripes, these opponents, their complaints, I think these are being directed to the broader national audience because yes, they're trying to block Measure 110 here in Oregon, but they're also, the success of Measure 110 is inspiring activists and legislators around the nation to put forward their own decriminalization measures. At least that's what I've been seeing. What kind of interest in reform have you been seeing in other states around the nation?
Yeah, there's definitely interest to follow Oregon's lead. We're seeing it already at the citywide level. Seattle City Council passed a decriminalization measure, and one of their city council members even stated that we're looking to follow Oregon's lead. Psychedelic decriminalization measures have been passed in a few cities. Detroit is voting on the decriminalization of psychedelics on the ballot this November. And I think we can expect drug decriminalization and similar measures as 110 that provide funding for drug treatment, harm reduction, and recovery programs to follow the same suit that medical cannabis and cannabis legalization laws have followed. And so I certainly expect our neighbors on the West Coast, Washington State, California, Colorado, to be joining us within the next 2 to 4 years.
Amazing progress is being made. Now, as we're recording this, just yesterday, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services endorsed needle exchanges and syringe service programs. He even said good things about supervised consumption sites, harm reduction intervention, which he supported back when he was a state official in California before going to D.C. Up in Canada, they're going even further and working towards safe supply and the creation of compassion clubs for people who use drugs. They're following the model, as you were mentioned a moment ago, the medical cannabis and model from years ago, and creating compassion clubs for people who use heroin, who use methamphetamine, who use cocaine. And just amazing progress up in British Columbia that we've been following the story closely on here on this show and others. Do you see any? Do you see potential for those really massive changes anytime in the near future, not just the interventions like syringe exchange, controversial, but they're happening, or decriminalization, controversial, but happening, but going even further to things like the safe spaces for consumption and safe supply?
Yeah, I see those occurring over, I think we're going to see dramatic changes over the next 10 years or so in the United States. And these advances that we're seeing in Canada and other places, people are going to monitor them just as they are monitoring Oregon, and just as we and other activists around the world monitored what happened in Portugal. And we're going to see that the drug war, arresting and jailing people, disproportionately people of color and poor people in general, has not worked and does not work. And waging a war on our own nonviolent citizens is not going to be a beneficial policy. It hasn't been a beneficial policy, and we're going to see that decriminalization, safe consumption sites, reallocation of law enforcement resources towards social services programs is a better policy. It's more humane, it's more compassionate, and then it's going to derive better benefits for everybody.
What question have I not asked yet that I should? I'm going to ask you for closing thoughts in a second too. So
yeah,
I just want to say,
I think we touched upon it, because I think the one thing that the media stories have missed thus far have been what have been the benefits of Measure 110 already. So I really think you asked the most pertinent question right off the bat.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, seriously, man, I've reading those articles. I'm just like, oh, this is. Just, I mean,
yeah, I mean, it goes a long way with. If it bleeds, it leads kind of media narrative that's always been there. And so it's so much easier to go along with really the law enforcement propaganda that the sky is falling, instead of looking at the nuances of the situation, and also just taking into account everything going on with society. You know, Measure 110 did not happen in a vacuum with COVID and the economy and our healthcare system. There's all kinds of issues that are impacting everybody, and it's not just the changes that Measure 110 brought along.
Yeah, well, and I imagine the cops and the DAs are squeezing the journalists and getting them to, you know, just...
And that's been a really a problem with a lot of media coverage, is that the law enforcement's word gets taken as gospel. And at least now we're starting to see more and more media at least become aware that you can't always take what law enforcement says. And we saw that with George, you know, what the police report about George Floyd was. You know, if there would have been a video of the George Floyd killing, it would, you know, the situation would have been totally differently. And so we see that narrative that, you know, going on now here in Oregon. You can't take law enforcement's word for it. You need to delve into the nuances of the situation and really look into where Measure 110 has already impacted people's lives and how lives are going to continue to be benefited by really transforming the how we treat drug addiction as a healthcare situation instead of a law enforcement one.
Give me your social media. What? How can people follow the work that you're doing?
Oh yeah, so people can see me and what I'm up to at AnthonyJ1977. That's how you find me on Twitter and Facebook. And then people should check out the Health Justice Recovery Alliance to stay on top of what is going on with Measure 110 and next steps for that. And that's at healthjusticerecovery.org.
Any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Oregon voters took a huge sledgehammer to the racist and failed drug war. And Measure 110 was the first step towards that. And we need to continue to implement the law and not jump to conclusions from the law enforcement propaganda that opposed the law and have said many of the same things about Measure 110 and Measure 110's implementation that they said about cannabis legalization and medical cannabis. These are all the sky is falling type stories that we've heard over and over. But all of the issues that we're seeing from, you know, in the streets of Portland and in our communities are from the failed drug war. And we've taken our first step towards it, and we need to see implementation through. We need to fund these programs that we need, and we need to support legislators and policymakers that understand we need to invest in people, invest in our loved ones. How do we want our loved ones to have drug problems and utilize drugs? How do we want them treated versus we need to invest in those people and instead investing more and more into prisons?
That was my interview with Anthony Johnson, a drug policy reform activist in Oregon who is chief petitioner of a ballot measure that legalized adult social use of marijuana and another measure that decriminalized simple possession of drugs. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for the Drug Truth Network, distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network to stations around the nation. Please support your local nonprofit and community public radio stations by donating or becoming a volunteer. Century of Lies is also a free download and podcast. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net, where you'll find a link to subscribe to the podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.